I often imagine the circumstances of my parents' first meeting. Him seeing her, she looking back at him, both of them at a Christian college, holding Christian Bibles, smiling Christian smiles at each other. And I wonder, had I been there as a ghost from their Christian future, would I have warned them away? Whispered, shouted, demanded, no, pick someone else. This person, while a good person, is not good for you. Would they have listened? Which means I have to wonder too, if the night I met the woman that would become my wife, did the ghosts of our unborn celebrate? Or did they scream for us to walk away? Today on Snap Judgment, from WNYC Studios, we proudly present Nuclear Family. Nuclear Family. Amazing stories from real people about the ties that bind. My name is Glenn Washington. You see, family is the one thing you both inherit and create while you're listening. Listening to Snap Judgment. We're going to start out today's Nuclear Family episode with a story spanning continents. See, when you travel to a country completely different from your own, there is always a learning curve. The language sounds different, the food, the customs, but usually there's one thing you can easily pick up on: a basic human connection.
In Uganda, there's a small city called Gulu. It sits near the equator. As soon as the sun sets, it's dark.
But as soon as the sun rises, it's bright. Within minutes, it goes from this very sleepy town to just bustling with energy.
When Jeanette Quinn first arrived in Gulu, that sudden liveliness is probably what struck her the most.
I think I had been there about 5 weeks. I was at this cafe that I would go to with my journal, drinking my coffee, when I saw this little boy on the veranda, and he had his arms on the rails. I figured he was probably about seven or eight. His entire chest is covered in scars that ran from one arm across his torso to the other arm. That was the first thing I saw, to be honest, were the scars. You know, we just looked at each other. We just watched each other. He just sat there and he looked at me and I looked at him. He actually lay on the sidewalk and some other kids came, walked over him and taunted him. That really struck me as well, that he was so alone. He ran off and I really kicked myself afterwards. I felt like there was something I should have done, or maybe there's something I could have done.
Jeanette, who was in her 40s, was a college student, and she was in Gulu for the summer, volunteering at a rehab center for former child soldiers caught up in Uganda's ongoing civil war. Jeanette figured that maybe she could help this kid too.
So I actually looked for him. And this is the thing, everybody knew who this boy was. The shopkeepers, they would say, oh, no, you'll never find him. You know, he moves around so that he doesn't get in trouble with the police. That he was mad, meaning that he was crazy, that he was a no-good boy, that he was trouble. Everybody was pretty much discouraging me to have anything to do with him. One morning, I was walking to the same cafe. I felt a little hand in mine, and I heard a voice say, Mono, itiamabe, which means white person, how are you? And I looked over, and it was him. I just couldn't believe that the boy who I'd been looking for was right there next to me.
As they walked through town, Jeanette learned his name, Opio. and she took Opio to work with her, where she fed him some porridge. It turned out that one staff member recognized Opio and helped Jeanette track down his mom and dad, who were living in a hut in a displaced persons camp.
When everyone was gathered there, I think they were all pretty shocked to see Opio with this white woman.
The family warmed up to Jeanette and told her about Opio's strange scars.
Opio was burned in a fire. It was actually in the midst of a revenge killing. It was his grandmother who was being killed, and he sustained third and fourth degree burns. Pretty severe. I mean, he did get treatment.
Doctors grafted skin from Opio's thigh and onto his stomach. But now these thick webs of scar tissue were binding Opio's arms to his sides. On top of being burned, Opio had epilepsy and had started having seizures. His mom said he was constantly running away, eating food out of garbage cans, and throwing stones at people for no reason.
For the mother, she was really at her wit's end because she couldn't keep him home. I think they'd kind of given up on him, and I think that it had to do with just not being able to do anything.
Jeanette told Opio's parents that she knew a surgeon in Gulu who could operate on Opio at no cost to them, and they were on board.
I didn't think that it would go beyond what I had done with these other kids. I certainly never anticipated that it would become anything like it did.
On the day of Opio's surgery, Jeanette sat in the operating theater as the nurse sedated him, and she was at his bedside as he recovered.
We would spend days in the courtyard of the hospital, and I think that's really when we started developing this deeper bond, and I think that he began to really trust me. He taught me a card game. It really requires a bit of strategy, and he was very good at it. One time, I was trying to leave the hospital. He tried to get me to stay by threatening to take off the bandages. The staff at the hospital said, you just have to go. I had no choice. I had to leave. I was in a van, and I remember looking out the window, and he was taking the bandages off. It was such a painful moment for me because there was nothing I could do. So we drove off, and suddenly the driver said, oh, we have to stop. And I looked in the back window, and Opio was running behind the van along the side of the road. You know, at the time, I had developed a relationship with him, and I was definitely unprepared for that. I didn't want to be this person who was there for him and was with him and then wasn't. I feel like I really could identify with him. My mother gave me up when I was 11. I mean, it's much more complicated than that. But I knew what it was like to glom onto an adult figure who might take care of me. And that's exactly what he did. You know, he would see me and he would race to me and jump into my arms. I would always have to brace myself just because of the force. It was sweet. He had just become this part of my life. I think I loved this boy, and I had to do what I could to take care of him and protect him.
So Jeanette came up with a plan. It was a life changer. She'd reached out to Shriners Hospital in Boston, where Opio could get the full medical treatment he needed for free. It also meant that Jeanette would have to take Opio to live with her in the U.S. for at least a few years.
You know, I had friends who questioned what I was doing. That's great that you want to help one child. In the long run, wouldn't it be better to finish your school so that you can help many children? I heard other people's arguments, and I knew that this is what I needed to do.
She discussed it with Opio's family, and the plan was clear. Once the surgeries were over, Opio would come home to Gulu.
So this was something that the family thought was a good idea, and Opio was very excited about going on a trip with me. When I picked him up at his home, he was just chattering, you know, nonstop, like, okay, let's go. I remember it so well because he never looked back. A friend of ours picked us up at the airport, drove us home. I remember him sitting in the back seat. You know, he was looking at everything and he was just bouncing up and down like this was a great adventure.
From day one, it was an adventure. The very next morning, Opio ran away.
So I walked down the street and found him with his shirt off because he was going to beg.
Opio kept walking away from Jeanette as she tried to reason with him in the middle of this quiet tree-lined street in the town of Northampton.
That was a pretty terrifying moment. Here I was with this child. I mean, it's one thing to be trying to contain a 2-year-old who is having a tantrum, but an 8 or 9-year-old who is having a similar tantrum looks very bad. Somehow I did get him back inside and fed him breakfast. But at that moment, I felt very demoralized. I did also feel like somehow or another, we were going to make progress.
Before Opio's first surgery, Shriners Hospital wanted to keep him overnight to assess him and make sure he could be calm.
Opio was good. He was great. And so he was playing with his toys while we were waiting to be called for the surgery.
And two nurses walked in. They wanted Opio to put his toy cars away.
And this is a boy who had never had toys before he came to the U.S., so, you know, he wasn't going to give up his cars. I tried to explain this to the nurses, and they said, you know, we really need you to step outside. And I stepped outside, and they walked towards him on either side of him, and he felt cornered. He reached to bite one of the nurses. The psychiatrist walked in right at that moment and said, oh, that's oppositional defiant disorder. And he said, we're canceling the surgery.
Opio was a traumatized boy. Not only had he been disfigured in a fire, he and his family had lived through a very brutal war. And now the doctors were telling Jeanette that Opio had severe PTSD. They would not operate on him until he went into a residential treatment facility first. So Jeanette started knocking on the door of every agency that could help. They all said no.
I mean, I was pretty frustrated, and I think I remember, what have I done? So I just had to admit that I'd made a really terrible mistake in believing that he would be able to get the services that he needed, which was just devastating. Ultimately, I thought, you know, he needs to go back.
So Jeanette packed their bags and booked 2 flights. On the way to the airport, she worried about what obstacles still lay ahead for Opio. She had actually found a rehab center in Kenya that worked with kids just like him. And after talking it over with his family, they all agreed that's where she would take him.
We got into the airport. I think it was the Kennedy Airport. I had our bags, and Opio ran away. He had taken off his shirt, and he was begging for money at the food court. And the security guard stopped us both, and he said, you're not going anywhere. And he took our passports, and Opio ran off again. He proceeded to take off all of his clothes in the middle of the airport, and he threw them all at me because he was angry at me.
The security guard called the cops, and Jeanette had to watch as Opio was put on a stretcher and carried into the back of an ambulance.
And I was in the ambulance with him, and I was trying to calm him down, but he was cussing me out in a Acholi, which was very funny. I mean, not at the time it wasn't funny. And I think that that's what people thought, was that this woman must really be very abusive to this child.
Opio went straight from the ER to the psych ward. And there, word began to spread to the local Ugandan community about a white woman struggling to save an African boy.
One man in particular encouraged people to call the Ugandan embassy to try to take Opio away from me. He actually equated me with Angelina Jolie, that Opio was like my African trophy, which was just stunning for me. The man from the Ugandan embassy did come and interview me, and he threatened me. He said that he had contacted my bank and found out how much money I had in my bank account. And I knew that the bank couldn't give out that information. So I knew he was lying. At one point, I said, you know, call Opio's parents and talk to them. And I gave them their numbers. And you have my information. We're leaving. And we did. When Opio was discharged, I'm sure I didn't know where to go or how it was going to work out. But, you know, I'd made a commitment to this boy. I couldn't let him down.
To Jeanette's luck, she found the one therapist who would see her and Opio, even though the therapist didn't speak Acholi. She found a residential treatment facility in Boston, willing to take him in for the next 16 months. And then she and Opio started going to a local Baptist church twice a week.
That was really the turning point for us. He was definitely calmer. I mean, he hadn't hit me or kicked me. When I came to visit, Opio was, he would just run and jump into my arms, just like he did when I would go visit him at his hut, at his home.
And in 2010, 4 years after he'd first arrived in the U.S., Opio went into the operating room. It was a tiny surgery, but for Opio, it was a giant milestone.
And so, you know, he said to me, well, I've gotten the surgery, and now, you know, you told me, Jeanette, we're going back to Uganda. That's what you said. He just missed his family, and he missed Uganda. And, you know, just doing some soul searching, I just thought, well, maybe this is what we need to do. Maybe for Opio's emotional well-being, it was best for him to be in the land that he loved. And I felt like I owed that to him.
So Jeanette got in touch with Opio's family.
And I told them that Opio really wants to come home. And the family said, well, he can't come and live with us. He's your child now. It was distressing to hear this. I was disappointed because Opio had improved significantly. I was not going to abandon him. That was not a possibility. And so the best thing that I can think of to do is to live with him and raise him in Uganda. And maybe in that way, he could kind of have the best of both worlds. He can be in Uganda. He can have contact with his family, and I will raise him. As we were preparing to leave, I felt like this had all been worth it for both of us.
Jeanette took a leave from school. She quit her job. She gave up her apartment. She gave up nearly half of her belongings and booked 2 one-way tickets to Uganda. She and Opio had been through so much that she was ready for whatever lay ahead. But when they arrived in Gulu, the first thing Opio did was run away, straight to his mother. A few days later, he came back to Jeanette.
He said, Jeanette, it's okay. It's okay. You can go back to America. It's okay. That he would be okay without me, I think, is what he was saying, which was huge. I mean, that was such a level of maturity that I hadn't really quite experienced with him. Suddenly, our relationship, not that it was over, but that, you know, I was sort of bereft. It was like, wow, you know, it was just my own sense of loss. You know, it was so quick. It was unexpected. Even though I was also happy that he was with his mother and that his mother had taken him back in, I knew that that was for the best. I knew absolutely that that was the best thing. And so 6 months later, I came back.
Okay. So the last time we were in studio, we talked about getting you and Opio on the phone,
right,
and taping the conversation to see how Opio is currently doing and what he remembers of his time here in the U.S. But something happened.
Right. I talked to Opio on the 14th of June. It was a video call, like a FaceTime. He looked really good. And he said, Jeanette, when are you coming to Uganda? And I told them that I was hoping to come in August. The next morning, I got up and I turned on my computer, and there were messages from Guido, our friend. So the last message was actually a video, and I turned on the video. I heard in the background a woman crying, a woman that looked just like Jennifer, and Jennifer is Opio's mother. She looked like a zombie. She just looked stricken. Guido panned over to the hut. I saw inside the hut, and there was a body covered in a grain sack. And the whole time I'm looking at it, I was thinking, you know, that can't be what I'm seeing, you know. And I saw the other messages, and it said, God has laid a heavy hand on us today, and our friend Opio has passed away. And even then, I thought to myself, he can't be talking about my Opio. It cannot be my Opio that he is talking about. And I typed in all caps, are you saying that Opio Ivan has died? And then Guido responded, I know this is really hard to understand, Jeanette.
Jeanette, what did he die from?
The family told me that he had a seizure and that he fell and that he went to sleep, which is what, you know, always happens. He sleeps for 20 to 30 minutes and then he gets up. But this time he didn't wake up.
Jeanette caught the first flight to Uganda. She didn't make it in time for the funeral, but Opio's family invited Jeanette to his mother's ancestral village. When she arrived, she saw three huts, a latrine, and a wash area. And then beyond, this little dirt path that led to a clearing. It's where Opio is buried. Jeanette stood by as the men in the family began a ritual called smearing of the grave. It keeps the spirits at bay and protects others from dying a similar death.
The ram was slaughtered. Water was added to the contents of the stomach, and that's what was smeared onto the grave. Then the shovels and the hoes were anointed with this oil as a protection again. And they actually asked for some few words from me. I felt like it wasn't my place. I said, you know, I really don't have anything. But they persisted. They said that I was one of Opio's mothers and that I cared for him. And it was because of me taking Opio to the U.S. that he was able to live as long as he did. I really appreciated that. You know, I felt very grateful, especially, I think, because I have spent so many hours, so much time thinking about whether what I did was the right thing to do. I talked with them, told them how grateful I was for them and in helping Opio and in giving to Opio. In the end, it was really Opio who gave to me.
Our sincerest condolences to Opio's family. And a big thank you to Jeanette Quinn for sharing her and Opio's story. She started a memorial fund in his name. We're going to have a link on our website at snapjudgment.org. The original sound design was by Renzo Gorio, and that story was produced with love by Nancy Lopez. When Snap Judgment returns, a romance like no other. When the nuclear family episode continues, stay tuned. Hey, Snappers. I've got two pieces of big news. First, Snap Judgment is going on tour. That's right, Snap Judgment Live. We're bringing it to Los Angeles, to Mesa, Arizona, to Seattle, Washington, Portland, Oregon, Minneapolis, Minnesota, Royal Oak, Michigan, and Chicago, Illinois. Looky here. If your city has not just been mentioned, don't worry. Don't get crazy yet. We're going to hit you again next time, sometime next year. So keep that in mind. And number two, we're about to put together the scariest spooked episode ever. And we want your story to be a part. And understand, we're looking for It's not, I saw a ghost. I don't care about that. I want to hear a story about how you interacted over time with an element of the supernatural. And if your story hits it, then we're going to put it directly in the Spooked 7 episode, our biggest episode of the year. Mark, what's the email for them to send it to? Send it to Boo, B-O-O, at snapjudgment.org. We can't wait for you to scare us, and we can't wait for you to hear Spooked. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the nuclear family episode. Today, we're examining the very special institution of family. And now we have changed the names of our storytellers for this next piece. You'll soon discover why. Sensitive listeners should know this story has some adult content. If you got kids around, they might want to sit this one out.
Sue was adopted at birth. Even though her mom and dad gave her a wonderful childhood, she always wanted to meet her birth parents. So as an adult, she hired a private investigator and found her biological family. Her birth mother, aunts, uncles, cousins, they all welcomed her with open arms.
When I met my entire birth family, they said, "You have a half-brother. We have the same father." I was shown a photo of Mike. He was wearing a tie-dye shirt. He had long hair. And he just looked like a bum to me. I knew he lived out of town, so I hadn't met him at the same time I met the rest of my family. So one day I was at work, and one of my uncles, my newly found uncles, brought him in and said, "This is your brother." Right now, as I sit here, I can see in my mind the first time I laid eyes on him. I looked at this man. I don't know what happened.
In the middle of her workday in a pub, Sue is standing behind the bar, serving drinks on autopilot with her mind racing a million miles an hour. 15 minutes ago, Mike was just an estranged relative, more of an obligation than anything. But now?
I was utterly horrified at the feelings I was having. I said to myself, this cannot be happening. This is wrong. This is completely wrong. And you cannot be feeling like this.
After a second, Sue snapped to. She realized who she was and who Mike was. And then everything just turned comfortably back into small talk.
I was busy at work. We couldn't really spend too much time together that night. So we made arrangements to go out for dinner to get to know each other. As I was getting ready, I thought to myself, the way I was getting ready, the way I was dressing, getting my hair done, makeup, perfume, I wasn't getting ready for a dinner with my newly found half-brother. I was getting ready for a date. And I thought to myself, what are you possibly thinking? This is not a date. We went out to dinner, and we had a really nice time, and we enjoyed getting to know one another. And by the end of it, I realized that there was an unmistakable attraction. It was there. I could not deny it. It was there. I thought to myself, no, this cannot happen, period. This is not happening.
But instead of parting ways, Sue didn't want the night to end. So she invited Mike inside her apartment.
We were sitting on the couch watching TV, you know, on opposite ends of the couch.
And we sat on the couch for hours talking, just basically getting to know each other.
And we just slowly inched closer and closer and closer.
And we looked into each other's eyes.
And that was it. Things happened. And we both realized that we had the same feelings.
And we just, we have to have each other.
It did creep in a little bit the next day. I thought to myself, Sue, what are you doing? What are you doing?
Sue was worried she was the only person who had ever gone through something like this.
That is when I went on the internet and did some research and luckily came across a website that explained the very common psychological phenomenon that is known as GSA. Genetic sexual attraction.
Genetic sexual attraction can happen when two family members are separated at birth and meet as adults. In many cases, GSA occurs with adoptees.
I know that on the face of it, it doesn't seem right. It seems, deliverance kind of thing.
Yes, a half-brother and sister falling in love might seem strange or wrong. You might even wonder if it's against the law. In most states, it is. You can even go to jail, but that wasn't going to stop Mike and Sue from being together.
He moved in with me after 1 week.
The first few weeks, it was, I had no idea what to, I had no one to talk to about it. It was just internalized.
You know, we just lived our lives. We put on our one face out in public and we put on our other face when we were home. It was a don't ask, don't tell. The reason we didn't address it is I think that neither of us wanted to acknowledge what was really going on. We both wanted to pretend like we were just a normal, average couple. And if we talked about it, then it became real.
Sue and Mike lived in the same town as some of their family members, so there was no telling when someone might just drop by.
Everybody knew that we were living together as brother and sister. So how do we manage, a loving, committed relationship while everybody knows us as brother and sister?
They moved out of state. They started a business together. And they told their new neighbors that they had met through friends.
Sue and I hid, and we had to play the charade. It was very difficult at times. I had the bright idea to set up a fake bedroom for myself so that when family visited our home, it wouldn't be so obvious.
When Sue's mom would come to town, they'd switch back to brother and sister roles during the day.
And I would sneak out in the middle of the night and kiss him and hug him. And we would do it in secret. And I remember how upset I was that we had to put on a charade.
Sue and Mike play this game for an entire decade.
I couldn't talk to anybody about it because my inner family were very strict Catholics, and I didn't feel that any of them would understand. I felt as though I would be somehow shunned or ostracized from my family, which we were always a very close family.
The whole time, I thought that Mike had a worse time dealing with it than I did. Mike never told any of his friends. He never told a single person. You know, I'm a talker. I like to talk things out. So a few trusted girlfriends I told.
And I was very apprehensive, very nervous. Didn't really agree with it so much, but she eventually said we need to make this known. Because if it's going to be real, it's going to be real. I said, we can talk about it with certain people and certain people I don't want to know. As more and more people found out, it boosted me up, you know. It absolutely reinforced how I felt about her. I eventually, one day, were sitting by the water, looking out over the ocean, holding each other. I said, "You want to do this? Let's do it."
I said, "What? Because you want to get married?" I said, "You're asking me to marry you?" And Mike said, "Yes." And I just looked at him and I said, "Hell yes. Yes, I will. I would be honored to be your wife."
It made me feel liberated. I was so relieved to finally express my true feelings. I said, "If we want to tell the world, I'm not ashamed."
Now, by law, in order to get married, you have to sign off that you are not blood related. Mike and Sue would have to lie and risk the consequences. If the authorities in their state found out they were half-brother and sister, they could be fined thousands of dollars, given years of jail time, and their marriage would be instantly annulled. It's at this moment, in many GSA relationships, that things can get really bad.
There are people like us, like Mike and I. They have their children being threatened to be taken away. They have family members calling the police and having them arrested. Broken families, families that don't talk anymore. I called my adoptive father to tell him. He was the last phone call I made. I literally shook as I dialed his number. My father's very conventional, and I thought he would immediately reject us. At first, I called him, and I said, "Dad, I need to tell you something. For the last 9.5 years, I've been living a lie, and I want to come clean." And I told him about Mike and I, and I told him that we were a couple. And he paused for a minute, and he said, "Sue, you underestimate me." He said, "I'm okay with it. I'm so happy."
Sue and Mike hired a local pastor, a woman. They had a simple ceremony in a park right on the ocean. They invited 20 of their closest friends.
And my mother was there, and my adoptive mother, and my stepfather was there, and my brother and his wife were there.
It felt amazing. Now I have responsibilities. Now I have a life to build for us.
The love that Mike and I have supersedes and transcends just a romantic and sexual partnership. And yes, I do believe it has to do with the fact that we're blood related. But see, we just don't even think about that anymore. It just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
Want to thank Sue and Mike, longtime Snap listeners, for bringing their story to us. The sound design for that piece was by Leon Morimoto. It was produced by Eliza Smith. When Snap Judgment returns, we put the nuclear in nuclear family. But Glenn, what do you mean? Well, stay tuned. The Snap Judgment nuclear family episode continues in just a moment. WNYC Studios, you're listening to Snap Judgment, the Nuclear Family episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and our next story, it is so hot, it is radioactive. Snap Judgment's Stephanie Fu spoke to Ken Silverstein about a very precocious teenager.
David was a fairly typical young boy. I mean, you know, rode around the neighborhood on his bicycle and played sports. And his grandfather, as a gift, gave him a book called The Golden Book of Chemistry Experiments. I think it was the 1960 edition. It was this period of great optimism about science, where science could cure every disease and eradicate poverty. And of course, nuclear energy was going to be too cheap to meter.
Here, in fact, is the answer to a dream as old as man himself, a giant of limitless power at man's command, in the atom.
And David just became a convert. He just became absolutely devoted to science. I mean, I talked to his old physics teacher in high school who said that David's dream was to collect every element on the periodic table, which is, you know, as this professor said, I don't know about you, but at my age, my dream was to get a car. He became very adept at using chemicals by making very elaborate fireworks and entertain everyone on the 4th of July. You know, these weren't just firecrackers, these were like major rockets. His parents vividly recalled one evening as they were sitting in the living room watching TV. David used to work down in the basement because he pretty much destroyed his bedroom with his experiments. I guess there'd been all sorts of fires and small explosions and chemical spills. And they heard a very large explosion and rushed downstairs, and David was laying on the floor in a sort of semi-conscious state. His eyebrows were smoking, his parents said. And it turned out that he had been experimenting with red phosphorus, which is highly explosive. He'd been pounding on it with a screwdriver when it blew up. For months afterwards, he had to return to the ophthalmologist, and he had to have pieces of embedded plastic in his eyes that he had to have extracted. But then he became interested in nuclear energy. And the simple explanation was that he remembered his parents sitting around the table fighting about how expensive electricity was. And he'd been reading about nuclear energy, and specifically about breeder reactors, which turned out to be this complete illusion. But the idea was that a breeder reactor would not only generate energy, but you would actually produce more fuel. As he was discovering science, he also got involved in the Boy Scouts. And David was a very exuberant Boy Scout and sought out to achieve the status of Eagle Scout. And to do that, David decided that he was going to try to build a nuclear reactor. So he was determined to help fulfill the dream of cheap nuclear energy. Being a teenager under the best of circumstances is difficult, and when your parents are divorced, it's probably a little bit harder. And I think part of what David was doing, and he would say as much, was that he was trying to exert some kind of control over his life. And he was very, very good at it, too. He impressed people. David was this very popular kid. He had a highly desirable girlfriend who was really impressed with his scientific achievements. He got a Geiger counter from a mail order house, and he used to drive around Detroit and go to antique shops and test old antique clocks, for example, with the Geiger counter to see if they were emitting radioactivity. Because back in the early part of the 20th century, they used to paint the faces of clocks with radium to make it glow in the dark, until they discovered, of course, that radium was highly radioactive. And in fact, the people who painted the clocks, lots of them died of cancer.
Radium, half-life, 1600 years.
He would write to smoke detector companies posing as a student doing a project for school. And so a smoke detector company sent him about 100 old detectors, and he extracted this little chip of americium in it.
Americium, half-life, 432 years.
He got thorium from old Coleman gas lanterns. Thorium is highly radioactive.
Thorium, half-life 14 billion years.
He wrote to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission posing as a professor and engaged in lengthy exchanges with an official at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission who kept providing him with information. Gee, what's the best way to purify radium? And he did right away and obtain very small samples of uranium from a company in Czechoslovakia.
Uranium, half-life 4.5 billion years.
He didn't just go out and get these gas mantles off these old Coleman lanterns and put them into a shoebox. He did do that. But before doing that, he actually was able, through incredibly elaborate experimentation, to purify some of these materials. He was using coffee filters to try to strain thorium and radium and stuff like this. The lab was a potting shed in the backyard. That was about as sophisticated as it got. No responsible adult intervened at any point. I mean, this was going on for years, 92, 93, 94, between the ages of 14 and 17. I mean, he'd be out until 2 or 3 in the morning in the backyard potting shed with a blowtorch, and he'd dispose of his clothing, and they thought it was cute. He was driving his car around 2:30 in the morning, and it's never been exactly clear what was going on, but somebody thought he was trying to steal tires from a car. The police came by and stopped him, and then they searched his car. They found a toolbox that was shut with a padlock and then sealed with duct tape. David was very vague and not very cooperative, in fact, but he did warn them that this might be radioactive materials in this toolbox. At which point the police did something very baffling. They were fearful that they had an atomic bomb on their hands, and yet they towed David's car to their own headquarters before deciding what exactly to do with it. And then they realized, oh, we might have an atomic bomb out in the parking lot. We better get everybody out of the headquarters and warn people away. And they ended up calling federal government officials at the Department of Energy and the Environmental Protection Agency and the FBI and deciding what to do about it. So then the feds and state officials go out to his mom's house and they discover this catastrophe in the backyard potting shed where they find jars of acids and Pyrex cups and all sorts of powders, and they seized all of the materials and they later tested it. I've got the records from the Environmental Protection Agency and the police reports, and they really did find excessive levels of radioactivity, high enough levels that they had to bury it at a low-level dump site in Utah. The highest count they found when they tested it was coming off of a vegetable can, and they found a count which was 1,000 times higher than normal levels of background radiation. It was 50,000 counts per minute. Thorium, it was found that he had purified it to at least 9,000 times the radioactive level found in nature. He had to have done sophisticated experiments to purify these materials. So this is when they realized that, you know, they had a serious problem. I mean, his mother lived in a residential neighborhood. There were tens of thousands of people in the area. They dubbed it an imminent and substantial endangerment to public health and welfare. And so they sealed off the shed. It really tried to keep this quiet. So one day the neighbors discover that there are men in funny white suits in the backyard cutting up this potting shed with chainsaws and putting it into radioactive containers. That's when the neighbors found out there was something really scary going on next door. This had been the focus of his adolescence. So when the police stopped him and they collected all of his materials and raided his shed, he told me that he was pretty bummed out at the time. In the end, it was determined, and rightly so, that David was not a terrorist. He was not out to build a nuclear bomb. He was not out to harm anyone. Look, it's impossible to build a nuclear reactor in your backyard. I mean, David's ambition was preposterous, and so he didn't come anywhere near his goal of generating nuclear energy. He did achieve some extraordinary scientific successes. He had gotten his Atomic Energy Merit Badge and he became an Eagle Scout. After graduating from high school, he joined the Navy and he was stationed for a time, oddly enough, on the USS Enterprise, which is a nuclear-powered craft. He was not allowed to be anywhere near the nuclear reactors because it was deemed that he'd already been overexposed to radiation in his life. I mean, he had assured me at various points that he had completely closed off that chapter of his life and that he was no longer interested in this sort of stuff. And then, you know, as I was completing the book, it turned out that he was planning trips up to Canada to scour for uranium. And so he still, for years, dabbled, and for all I know, still does, in these sort of scientific experiments.
Big thanks to investigative journalist Ken Silverstein. Based out of D.C., he wrote the book, The Radioactive Boy Scout, upon which this story is based. Thanks as well to Harper's Magazine and Emil Klein for the story. Now, it's been years since we first aired this piece, which has a half-life of its own, but know that David is doing great. The sound design was by Renzo Gorio, and it was produced by Stephanie Fu. It's that time. It is, but you want more Snap storytelling. I understand. And I've got what you need. No dark alleys required. Full episodes, including never-before-broadcast specials. Subscribe to the Snap Judgment Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, snapjudgment.org. Snap is produced by the team that knows the entire periodic table. Give it up for the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. Our mad scientist crew, Pat Masidi Miller, Anna Sussman, Nancy Lopez, Eliza Smith, Davey Kim, Joe Rosenberg, Teo Dakot, Renzo Gorio, Leon Morimoto. The power grid is managed by Jasmine Aguilera. And even though this is not the news, no ways is the news. In fact, you could mix up some cesium, some barium, some uranium with some frozen bananas in the blender to harness the power of the gods for your smoothie, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is, but this is WNYC.